This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we continue our drumbeat coverage on the unfolding crisis in Haiti. As hundreds of thousands of people are dead following the massive earthquake, we'll speak to Walter Riley, Bay Area-based civil rights attorney just back from Port-au-Prince. Also, Bill Quigley, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, talks about the large U.S. military presence in Haiti and the undermining of relief efforts that puts more lives in danger. We speak to a medical doctor in Port-au-Prince who has set up a makeshift hospital to treat thousands of patients. Yvonne Carazon of the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund gives his eyewitness account of the suffering. And Flashpoints' Kevin Pina heads back to Haiti. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we again return to Walter Riley. Walter Riley was in Haiti for the earthquake. He is a civil rights attorney. He works with Danny Glover and others on various civil rights issues. Very familiar with Haiti. And welcome back, Walter Riley. We talked to you on a day devoted to Martin Luther King. I'm sure he would be out there with his hands rolled up doing what he could. Tell us, first of all, just remind people where you were when the earthquake hit and just say a little bit about what's been going on since.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you to the KPFA community who has given tremendous support and concern for me individually, my family, and the work that we do. At the time of the earthquake, I had just finished a day of talking to people who were involved in struggles on the ground, grassroots organizations in Haiti, people that the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, Haiti Action Committee, people have been working with over the long term, and particularly since the coup against Aristide and the democracy movement in Haiti. I was in a house eating, and the earth and the house started to shake tremendously, like I've never seen before, because I was in the Loma Prieta court in my house. This was not like that. And had that house not been able to stand, we would have been covered in rubble and heavy blocks. I'm certain would not have made it out, but the house stood, and we got outside into a courtyard. And immediately it was clear that there was tremendous damage. We could see the smoke dust rising over Port-au-Prince. Big boom because the gas station near us exploded. A hospital within walking distance of where I was collapsed. I was not far from the palace up the hill behind it. Screaming and people in the streets. We went into the street and saw unbelievable damage. The kinds of images you see on television. It's hard.
It's okay, Walter. It's okay. Take a deep breath.
And people were in pain from their injuries. People were in pain from seeing their loved ones, people they know, crushed. Their homes destroyed. It was immediate. It was not something that occurred slowly. It was immediate and devastating.
And you and your wife were there out in the courtyard beginning to see this suffering unfold. What happened next for you?
Well, we were aware that we were okay. Because we got into an opening and the place that we were in did not crumble. And we immediately said, we have to see what we can do for other people. The host that I was there with at the house, Yvonne Carnesan, and I went out into the streets. Other people there started to gather what resources they had. We knew that we had to get water and food, and they started together what they could. We immediately had people come in who we thought we could help right away. Other people were doing what they could for first aid in the streets. We had some people come into the courtyard because we had some space there. And we invited people in and started to give them first aid. We went inside and got soap and water, and we got peroxide and alcohol and T-shirts and started to make strips so that we could bandage people.
And as you did this kind of first aid work, I imagine you were beginning to sense the gravity of the situation. As you worked with the people, describe a little bit more about what you saw around you, the people that you saw, and what seemed to be their initial response.
I could spend time describing the pain, the suffering, and that was there. I think you could imagine what happened. You could imagine, and perhaps you've also seen images. Everybody has. And all of that was present, even in small spaces. There was no space, I believe, in Port-au-Prince where there was not tremendous suffering and blood and broken bones and dead people. But what I think is important to remember is, for me, is that people started to cooperate. People screamed. Many people thought it was the end. People didn't understand, and it wasn't clear to me how it could happen in Haiti. We didn't expect earthquakes. Hurricanes, yeah, but no earthquakes. And people began to work with each other. What you see when people are pulling bodies out of rubble is an aspect of what can happen when folks work together. And that's what happened. There was that sense of, this is horrible, this is terrible, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to go do something. I'm going to really help somebody. And that was that went on. This was 5 o'clock, but so it seemed very quickly it was dark, and we were assisting folks coming out of rubble while there were still people in the courtyard giving first aid. I was with someone who was trying to pull a person out of a rubble on the side of a hill when the second quake occurred. And that was devastating, because the cries and screams from the people who were already still inside was just horrifying, as they were covered in the rubble of the places they were trapped in. And it was, as I said before, it could have been 100, could have been 1,000. It seemed like tens of thousands of screams. And I'll never forget it. And that's the sad part that we all remember from tragedies. The thing that we do see from here is just the spirit of people who survive, and as they've done in Haiti, perhaps in many other places, but certainly in Haiti for all these years, in the midst of the greatest hardships, there's something in the spirit and the dignity of people that they survive together and they work together. And that's the hope for Haiti, the people.
Well, I want to talk to you just a little bit more of the politics here. It is of grave concern to us producers on the Flashpoint show that the United States government turned this rescue operation into a military operation, and the timing here is way off. Your response to the U.S. reaction so far?
Well, I was there for several days, and we saw no response from anybody in government helping the Haitian government, the U.N., and the U.S. or the emergency crews. It was clear that things were going to get worse, so because we could get out, we got out, and I didn't want to be a burden on the folks that were there, but there was nothing I could do in the long term except to suffer more. The government has not responded to the areas. I'm hearing from people who are right downtown in front of near the palace that there is very little being done for some of the people there. There's a medical clinic that doesn't have supplies. The Aristique Foundation has 53 doctors and several thousand people who need help there. The doctors were without supplies for a few days. They need supplies. They need help. Some of the doctors from the Aristique Foundation went to a place that I had just visited that day, which is Sopadep. It's a school for people that we have given support to, that many people in the Bay Area may have met. Rhea, who is the director of that school. And they've turned that school into a clinic for for medical aid. They're looking for medical supplies to keep that school going. They are now providing medical aid to people who need it. They're not getting it from any of the relief foundations. I know there are images of work being done, but they haven't gotten any. There are various places where it hasn't rolled out. We're told that the rollout takes a long time, but there were 9,000 or so UN troops on the ground. They didn't need to roll out. They were already there. They spent their time dealing with the collapse at the UN building. These are soldiers from places that have lots of resources. These are people who could march up to a place and carry food and water, and they didn't carry food and water. These are people who trained to work for days. They didn't do that. They stayed in their place and waited for some rollout. The U.S. has completely militarized the airport and militarized the zone. And as I understand, when Hillary Clinton did her photo op, Doctors Without Borders was turned away in medical care. I'm told that at some point or another, the French had sent a field hospital complete, and that was turned away. I have been told of the images of the Israelis putting on the ground a completely equipped hospital with all kinds of supplies, that it can be done, but it didn't get done and still isn't being done. People are dying unnecessarily because they don't have medical care, because they don't have water. And it's not just because people are caught in crushed and being crushed in buildings and not getting out, and that's true too. We don't have rescue squads in some places where people are using their fingers and sticks to try to get people out. It would be helpful to have rescue squads there. But let's say for the people who are living in the streets that need some water, that need some food, that need some bandages, that need some antibiotics, that could be carried to them, and they haven't gotten it. Why is it that it isn't being delivered? How close is this to the indifference that our government had for Katrina?
Well, many people are calling this situation Obama's Katrina, except that, unfortunately, it's even a lot worse, and that was terrible. I guess I was shocked to hear when I spoke with Laura Flynn of the Aristide Foundation, to hear that the foundation, I guess, is around a mile from the airport. You mentioned all those doctors in the foundation, thousands of people in need, and a mile away, and that was when after the military took over, you couldn't get any aid, although it was piling up on the tarmac there. It's fairly shocking.
It is shocking, and I think that we have to hold our government accountable. We need to hold the people who make these decisions accountable, and we need not accept that they can't get people out. I mean, they militarized it, and yet they didn't use the military to get the work done. The land, the area in front of the palace is clear. Every time you see images of the palace, you see a gate and you see a large area. Why didn't helicopters land there and drop off people who could do some work, who could start to spread it from there? There were open spaces where they could have dropped off people with helicopters to do work. That didn't happen. And this claim that they need time to roll out doesn't make sense. They were there on the tarmac at the airport, and they didn't roll out, didn't get it done. I find it unacceptable, and I'm willing to accept that they couldn't get it done. It could be done, and even now it can be done better than it is.
One final question, Walter, and this goes to the what you witnessed on the ground as opposed to what we're hearing coming over the mainstream media. We're hearing more and more about unruly crowds, about Haitians looting, about the dangers regarding national security, and yet we keep getting reports that under the circumstances, this poor community did its best to survive in the face of a refusal of the world to help in a way, or for the United States to let the world help. What's your response to this?
My response is it's ridiculous. I was in a place where we were running out of water. My host went to a place where there was water and said, I need 2 bottles of water, of those gallons of water. And he was told, no, you can't get water. And he says, I'm going to take this water. You'll have to shoot me. And that was getting water to help other people in our place where we were doing medical aid for folks. That's not looting. You know, if I had stayed there until Sunday, I would have been hungry, thirsty, and desperate. What would I do if I saw a truck with water on it? I myself surveyed places that looked like they were pharmacies, and I wondered how I could get into those places to get medical supplies. I didn't get into them because it was too dangerous. But if I had been able to pick up medical supplies in some place that had them, I would have. And I don't think that what people are doing is looting. I think what most people are trying to do is to help themselves, help each other to survive. And they're not taking in some immoral way. Now, there's no doubt that there's going to be some violence. And there's no doubt there's going to be a great deal of frustration the hungrier and the thirstier and the more desperate people get. That's what a crisis is. That's desperation that occurs from the lack of needs being filled. And we can expect that. But this is not a place where there is tremendous chaos. There's more order than there is disorder. The disorder is in the conditions that are around them that they're trying to live with, and they're making order out of it. There is the positive aspect that people are maintaining some sense of organization and dignity in their lives, even in the face of a catastrophe of this order that we have not seen, any of us have seen before. I cannot accept any characterizations of what I saw and even what I see on television as major disorder. Most of it you will see will be close-up shots that make it look like large crowds of people doing things. But if you pull back, you don't see large crowds of people doing things terrible. You see large crowds of people doing things to help each other or to survive or to get past, and not doing things that are harmful to other people. In any place, in any situation, there will be some harm being done to another individual by one individual because of their desperation, their lack of decorum, for one reason or another, or because they just become so desperate and disordered individually. But for the most part, this is a situation where people are making order out of chaos.
All right. Civil rights attorney Walter Riley, caught in the earthquake in Haiti, spent days trying to save lives. What would you recommend people who want to help do at this point, Walter?
I think people should try and pay attention to what's happening with the situation in Haiti through their media, through their contacts, through their friends. They should give support to organizations that are trying to do work. They should encourage people to have a sense of what the positive work is that can be done. And I would encourage people to give money to the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, where we are trying to get things and support to people on the ground who are both doing material aid to people and trying to maintain some political sense of order in the fight for democracy. The other thing I think is more important.
And how do they do that? How do they give that aid?
They can give that aid by sending money to Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. They can go on the internet to Haiti Action Committee, do the link to the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund on the link, donate by credit card or by PayPal. They can send money to Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. They can send it in any places. They can send it to the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund by going to the web. I'm not looking at it at this point because you called me when I was... I'm actually in a meeting with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund right now.
Sorry about that.
They can send it through that. They can send it to the East Bay Sanctuary Covenant, which is at 2362 Bancroft Way, Berkeley, California, 94704, made out to the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. The other thing that's important is to call upon our people in the U.S. Congress, our senators and our legislators, our congresspeople, to develop an oversight about the spending, how the money is being spent, who is it being spent with, who is in charge of the money, where it goes. There has got to be immediate oversight of that money so that it goes to some real relief and some real rebuilding. Haiti is going to be rebuilt. That's the nature of Haiti. It's the nature of this situation and any situation. Those buildings will be rebuilt. People will continue to live in Haiti. the question is how it gets rebuilt, who is doing the rebuilding, and what it means to the people of Haiti in the process of being rebuilt. And unless we give the political oversight to that in a way that benefits people with some sense of humanity and human dignity, it won't be done in the best interest of Haitians. We can, in the Bay Area, ask our congresspeople to exercise extreme oversight and build a committee. I want the Black Caucus to have a committee. I want the Progressive Caucus to have a committee. I want to see John Conyers and other people organize to ask for reports for what the U.S. is doing and how it's doing it, and detail the manner of its relief so that we know that it serves some interest beyond profit-making.
All right. Walter Riley, we thank you for the service, the very important information, your courage. We wish you the best and your family a safe return to the work here in the Bay Area. We will keep our dialogue open with you, and we'll keep covering the story. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
This is Bill Quigley. I'm the legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. I've been to Haiti about 20 times as a human rights lawyer, working with other folks on the case of Père Jean Juste, and also as a Katrina survivor and active there. The concerns that are emerging from Haiti are, unfortunately, ones that are familiar to those of us who survived Katrina. There's an awful lot of over-militarization of the response, the need, a constant talking about the need for security, the need for safety, the constant warnings that people are on the edge of rioting, which it ends up being a lot of blame the victim, and it clearly makes people more agitated because you wait and wait and keep them from getting the water and food and drink that they need. I know, for example, I've worked in the Catholic parish of Père Jean Juste, which is maybe a mile away from the airport in Port-au-Prince. You can see the airport very clearly from the church because it's up on a hill. You can watch the planes land there and that. And the people of that community have not yet received a single thing through the airport or any of those operations. And this is thousands of people. They actually have received assistance from a person that a lot of your listeners know well, Lavarese Godin, who's from Florida. He flew over to the Dominican Republic and working with the What If Foundation, that foundation that Father Jean Juste set up, and a Dominican foundation, drove three truckloads of food and water and medicine over to this parish, and that's the only assistance they've received. They haven't received anything directly from the airport at all. I talked with another friend of mine, Vladimir, who is a multilingual person down there. He said the price of everything has doubled. I asked him, what was the price of milk? And he texted me back, milk, with a question mark. There is no milk in Port-au-Prince. The reports that we're hearing from people is that the dead people are everywhere. They've cleared most of them out of the street, but all of the buildings are full of corpses of people, the schools, the churches, the houses, and people are afraid to go back into any structure because they're still getting aftershocks. Real concerns about the prevalence of the United States military and the United States military taking over the airport, taking over the, many people think, taking over all the decision-making of the country. And the experience of Katrina and the experience of the tsunami social justice folks who survived that disaster is that you have to work very, very closely in partnership with the community organizations and the people on the ground if you really want to get something done. Certainly, we need security, and humanitarian assistance workers need security as well. But your listeners will know that there have been no reported incidents of anybody attacking any relief workers at this point. It's been a week. You know, you're talking hundreds of thousands of desperate people. The community, the ministers, the women of the community, the youth leaders and those folks, they know how to work this out. They're begging the United Nations and the soldiers and the relief organizations to work with them. They'll put people in lines. They'll protect everybody. They'll get all this out. Instead, these humanitarian relief is backing up, and it's really a tragedy. The other thing that's so important It's not just a humanitarian tragedy that we're looking at. It is a human rights tragedy. And so therefore, in any way that there's going to be reconstruction, rebuilding, anything like that, that reconstruction has to be based on human rights principles, starting with the basic human dignity of every person, but going into issues of accountability and transparency for the governments who are coming in and the soldiers who are coming in, but also for the 10,000 non-governmental organizations that set up shop in Haiti. That's one of the reasons that people who are in solidarity with the folks in Haiti are saying, if there's assistance that comes, the decisions have to be made when it comes, where it comes, and the logistics and the choices have to be made by the Haitian people themselves, because part of the reason that the devastation from this quake was so terrible is that systematically the authority of the Haitian government, the authority of the Haitian people has been undermined, shortcut, run around, and that for decades. And as a result, the public sphere, that is what you call on in time of emergency, the public sphere is terribly, terribly weakened. And for the Haitians to survive, and they will survive, for them to survive after the world's attention goes to the next disaster, it will depend on the Haitians themselves. And they have to be empowered, given the tools, given the ability to make the decisions, given the money to be able to rebuild that country for themselves, and to do that in cooperation with the other Haitians who are outside of the country. The other thing that's so problematic in a story I heard today was I got a text from a friend who said, my mommy and one of my sisters and a couple of our nieces and nephews were able to get on a plane to Orlando, but my sister couldn't come. And so I texted her and said, why couldn't your sister come? I said, because my sister had as Haitian citizenship, because she kept that so that she could work in Haiti. And they took her children onto the plane because they were United States citizens. And they took her grandmother onto the plane because she's a United States citizen. But they wouldn't let the mother go with her children to the United States, even though she has a visa. She's been back and forth to the United States dozens of times. And they said the plane was filled with children whose parents just handed them off to strangers to take them to the United States because the children were United States citizens and the parents were not. And that has a real echo with our experiences in Katrina, where they did evacuate children. They evacuated babies in incubators, but they didn't take the mothers with them because of somebody's priorities about how those things should happen. So splitting up families and, the warning that the United States and others are saying about don't try to come to the United States unless you're a citizen because we will lock you up or we will turn you around immediately. That's not the kind of thing that we should be talking about now. We should be extending our embraces to people there as our sisters and brothers. And truly, if they were our sisters and brothers, we would do anything for them. And that's what people are doing for their sisters and brothers. But this is one of our, geographically, one of the closest countries in the world to the United States. But we are still afraid of them. We are militarizing the relief. We are demonizing them. We are engaging in a blame the victim thing, and the United States has used and abused Haiti for almost two centuries at this point. And this is an opportunity to reverse that, to be in a respectful relationship, and to reverse some of the dealings that the United States has had over time. We can't allow the Fox News people and the other people on the far right to say, look, these are people are violent, these people are primitive, these people have a culture of poverty, these people have different religions than we do, they're different colors than the people in the United States. We can't allow that to divide us, because the next step after that is, well, we've given them a little something, now the rest of it's on their own because they're really not the same as us. And the experience is that they are our sisters and brothers. And I just want to close, Dennis, if I could, with probably the most terrible thing that I've heard yet, which is I have a four-year-old godchild in the Dominican Republic. I was best man at the wedding of the child's parents, and the father called me last night and actually sent me a text, didn't call, couldn't talk, and said, would you please take our four-year-old daughter to live with you in the United States? Because our country, our Haiti, our Port-au-Prince, is destroyed, and it will be 10 or 15 years before we're even back to where we were before the earthquake hit, and this is no place for a four-year-old. My four-year-old says, are we going to die next, Daddy? Why are all the people dead, Daddy? And her school is destroyed, their home is destroyed, and they're wandering around in Port-au-Prince trying to do what they can. But he's ready to give up his own child to people in another country that where he won't, the child won't be able to see her parents or her grandparents or anybody else because he feels that his country is so destroyed. And when you hear stories like that and when people talk to you like that, you recognize these are our sisters and brothers. We have to treat them fairly. We have to treat them respectfully. And what we have seen so far, in my estimation, from what I'm hearing from people on the ground, we haven't seen 10% of what's actually happened in Haiti and the destruction and the deaths and the devastation. And this is going to be one of the real challenges for the rest of our lives is how to deal with these folks. So I appreciate you having me on and the other people telling the stories of Haiti. And, you know, I wish you the best and I wish your listeners the best. And we just have to pull out all the strings to do what our sisters and brothers in Haiti want us to do. Let them make the decisions, have them tell us what to do, and then we'll do it.
You're listening to this week's Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, a roundup of the past week's most important interviews and news segments. Stay tuned.
Let me say bienvenue. Did you notice helmets? Colors are baby blue. UN soldiers patrol, or should say occupy. Responsibility to protect such a lie. Like a late night, we run old drama repeated. Same story played again, while the act conceded. The poor majority, innocent or guilty. True solidarity against a war treaty. Most the same foreign troops out here to kill bandits. Stolen page from the past, use tricks underhanded. It's the same difference, history repeats itself. But masses will not bow down to those with wealth. That's why my expression against the oppression should serve as a lesson for all those who still question. Don't trust the blue helmets as far as can be thrown. They made City Soleil a UN war zone.
First of all, Dr. Serena, why don't you talk about exactly where you are now and what you're doing? I understand you've put together a makeshift hospital.
Right now, I'm living in Port-au-Prince, and I'm still working there. What's happening after the earthquake, the first one on the January 12th, soon after we realized that they have a lot of injured people in the street that where I was living. Most of the house was destroyed at that time, and the people on the street was crying and they have blood all over the place. Then what I did, the first place that I have available since my house this was too affected, then I invite them to come to my yard and try to at least take care of their problem. And that's what that begins. And at the end, we treat more than 150 people. And that people right now are recovering slowly. And some of them who need surgery was referred to Riaz Hospital. And so far, among that group, only 7 of them died. Then that I think that was good for the people on the neighborhood that we can open that setting and they can get help as quickly. Then we didn't have more casualty than one can expect in that area.
Could you describe what your day was like today and some of the kinds of wounds that you've been treating?
Okay, that's two different things. What they look like today in Port-au-Prince, when you go on the street and you go to, let's see for myself, when I go to work, I get the feeling that Port-au-Prince is empty. A lot of people leave Port-au-Prince to the countryside. They try to go back to their family at the countryside. Then the few who are remaining, that the one who has no possibility to move or who has to work there. When you look at that Port-au-Prince, one can be depressed because, you know, you find all of the house on the ground. And you can see in some place you see the people, you know, were still asking for help. Some of them need water, other need food, and mostly they need shelter. Then that's a quite difficult situation for the population these days. And that's the way in Port-au-Prince. You don't see, you know, open place, marketplace. You cannot go in some place to buy food. Everything is closed. Today we get a little improvement. We have a gas station we are open. That was a real improvement since people can have gas for their car. They can go further. They don't have to stay in Port-au-Prince. They can go in other city to get the food and water they need for the family. That's the way it is. For the people who are injured that I take care of them, most of them was like a broken arm, broken legs. They were injured in the head. Some of them have eyes problem. Some of them are really big polytrauma with big laceration. Most of them, that's what we found, is, you know, type of laceration. People who are under the ground, we have broken, was for them because the block fall on their heads. That's the type of things that we have to face after.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Haiti is planning to house 400,000 earthquake survivors in new tented villages outside the capital of Port-au-Prince. They're talking about 10,000-person villages in tents. At least 75,000 bodies have so far been buried in mass graves. This is from the government statistics. Many more remain uncollected in the streets, they say. They have no schedule for moving some 400,000 people. The situation remains desperate, and the U.S. military, which is planning to be 15,000 or more strong, has seized control of the airport and the perimeters. They are turning away a number of planes. According to Doctors Without Borders, at least five of their planes carrying some 77 tons of medical and relief supplies have been turned away in the past week. Only one has been able to land. We continue our coverage of the situation in Haiti and are joined on the telephone by Yvonne Curzon. He's a Haiti activist, organizer, has worked with friends here in the Bay Area with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, and he joins us from New York City. Are you in Manhattan or Brooklyn, Yvonne Curzon?
Right now I'm in Manhattan, and I like to take the opportunity to thank everyone who is doing everything, no matter how small they think it might be. But in Haiti right now, we are in dire need of help, and anyone who can help, and anyone who is doing anything, my heart goes to all of them.
Well, thank you very much, and we definitely want to keep our reporting going. We want to keep the information fresh. We want people to understand exactly what things look like, because as you know, sometimes the mainstream press is dismal and a total failure, and it's hard to figure things out. I guess let me just start this way. You were actually hosting for Walter Riley and Barbara Ryan when the earthquake hit. You were with them when it hit, correct?
Yes, we were there in Port-au-Prince at my house, having a late lunch, when all of a sudden everything started shaking and the table we were eating just moved away from us. And it took me a while to realize what was going on. And Walter was the one who told me that, you know, the first hour was crucial. And then, if we can, whatever we can do to save people, that's what we were going to do. And then we got up, we went to the neighborhood, we helped putting some people out of the breeze, and, you know, and before you know it, the house turned into a hospital because there are three hospitals in the area, and all three of them had collapsed. And people started coming, and because there was no other place for them to go. And we were blessed that we could be of service when people really, really needed help.
Tell us about a little bit more about what was going through your mind. This is your country. You have seen so much devastation, so much suffering amongst the people. What was going through your mind, and what were some of the images that were catching your eye?
The thing is, I don't think anyone knew the magnitude of what happened, because there was no the telephone lines were all dead. There was no electricity. There was nothing. And we had at the house, since we have inverter, so we still had a little bit of electricity up until around midnight. But after that, it was all dark. But, you know, I've seen a lot of suffering in Haiti, but that degree of devastation, that was the first time. And I really, really see it the next day when Walter and Selena and I, we went to see some people that saw a guy that had a broken arm, and then it was only then that we realized how bad things were. I mean, close to the house, we've seen other houses collapsing, and you're watching it, and you know you got to do something. But when you go out and you see Port-au-Prince doesn't exist anymore, it's all rumbles everywhere you go. I don't think there are three houses in the world that stayed up in most of the capital. Most of Port-au-Prince is destroyed completely. And it is not just Port-au-Prince. You have cities like Léogane, like Jacmel, like Tiguan, they all destroyed. See, and it's hard to imagine that something like that can happen in less than 1 minute. It was only 38 seconds, and, you know, that's what happened. That's what happened in 38 seconds.
Now, we're learning today that Haiti officials, and they have been scarce and silent for the most part, essentially turning over the control of the operation to the U.S. military. But we heard today that they're planning to move 400,000 earthquake survivors to these villages outside of Port-au-Prince. They're going to be housing 10,000 people in a village. Give us your sense, knowing, as you know, the extent of the destruction, because you walked around it for days and you helped to save lives. What is your assessment in terms of what's going on the ground, and could a program like this work?
Dennis, the first thing I like to say is that there is no control. So the Haitian government is not turning control to anyone, because you cannot give something that you don't have. And they had no control. The first 48 hours, the people of Haiti were left alone. No one was doing anything to help them. No official government. The minister within Haiti, they have over 11,000 people working for the United Nations in Haiti. You did not see one of them until Thursday that was doing anything to help the people. By Thursday night, not one bottle of water is given to the people, excuse me. And if the United Nations and the people working for the United Nations in Haiti had taken the time to help, we would have saved a lot more Haitians, a lot more people would have been saved. You see, up until yesterday, they were still, I don't know what happened today, but until yesterday, they were still pulling people alive. You imagine how helpful minister would have been if they had started the time immediately after the earthquake? Can you imagine how many people, how many lives would have been saved? But the government was No, nobody knew where they were. I can sympathize with the United Nations because they did lose a lot of people. However, when you are in the military, you cannot spend 36 hours mourning while other people are dying. It makes absolutely no sense to me or to anyone who was there. Walter can tell you that. We got absolutely no help. The one good thing, though, is how Haitians, especially the young ones, how they pulled together, they organized teams, and they were going throughout the city in the rumble, risking their lives to save other Haitians. And when it comes down to it, you see that the only people we can really, really depend on are the Haitians and friends like yourself, like Walter, and other people that were with us before all these things happened. I mean, it's hard. It's a bit cynical to even think that way. However, when we were in that real thing, the United Nations proved to us that they were a force of occupation, nothing else. They weren't there to help the people. They're not there to maintain peace, like they're saying. But they're only there to oppress, to occupy the country, and to make sure that the people of Haiti stay quiet in spite of all that they are going through.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Yvonne Carzan. He was with Walter Riley and Barbara Ryan. They were staying at his house in Port-au-Prince, just outside of Port-au-Prince, when the earthquake hit. And we're talking about the situation on the ground. And, of course, you were there a number of days after the earthquake hit, and you had a chance to see a great deal. One of the things that we heard from U.S. military, and we still hear it, and we hear complaints from many other countries that the U.S. military is continuing, while they're doing some cleaning up, they're continuing to impede key aspects of the relief program. Your response to that?
Well, this is one thing that I really don't understand, because if you are there to help, and somebody else also want to help, I don't know. I cannot, for the life of me, understand why you're stopping other people from helping. There's one thing that I was against. It's for the United Nations to lead the recovery or the help that's been given to Haiti. That I was against, because the United Nations doesn't have a good record in Haiti when it comes to helping people. However, to stop other nations from helping, to me, is senseless. It doesn't make sense. We have a lot of people that they need help. I mean, Walter, Barbara, and I, we were there helping the people. But we had very little to work with. We only had 2 bottles of hydrogen peroxide, a bottle of alcohol. We use our underwear to clean up the wounds that the people had in their heads and other parts of their body. That's how much we needed supplies. And to be stopping aircraft that are bringing supplies in Haiti, to stop doctors, nurses, and other medical personnel from going there and help the people, that, frankly, I don't understand.
You're listening to this week's Best of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, a roundup of the past week's most important interviews and news segments. Stay tuned.
And we are back, and you're listening to Flashpoints. We have been covering Haiti with Kevin Pina for almost 20 years, and we have seen so many different things happen. We have seen you come and go, Kevin, in the middle of coups, in the middle of liberation, in the middle of the return of Aristide, in the middle of him being thrown out of the country in a U.S.-supported coup. You're heading back again. What's on your mind? What are you hoping to learn? What's the the plan?
Well, I got to be honest, I am kind of tired. I'm looking forward to sleeping on that flight to Miami, to be honest. The last couple of days have really just, I mean, this last week.
Well, I know you've been on the phone around the clock with stations around the country.
Well, not just that, but also on the phone with Haiti and getting messages from people who need help because there's not help happening on the ground.
Tell us about that.
Well, my wife's aunt just called us. Her aunt and her five cousins are stuck over by the Université Quisqueya. They have no water, no food. To be honest, they're drinking their own urine to survive right now. That's how thirsty they are. We've been trying for the last 2 days to get people to them. I've been trying to direct people with satellite phones to their location. Apparently, the cell phone has finally died on their... The battery has finally died on their cell phone, so now I don't know quite what to do. I dispatched a couple friends again today with motorcycles to try to find them, desperately seeking them. At the same time, my wife's husband, that's right. Yes. I'm a little tired, but I'll be all right. My wife's father has hurt his leg. His leg is badly injured, and we're worried that he might lose it, so we're trying to get him proper medical attention. We understand it's swollen, it's pussy, it's something that needs, it's infected and it needs immediate attention.
And there's nothing you can do.
There are things. I mean, there are people that I'm on the phone with on the ground. We're trying to get them there, but their need is so great. And the roads, of course, are, you know, blocked still with rubble. And of course, the U.S. Marines are also blocking movement, you know, throughout the capital as well. They're controlling the flow of movement. As I said, I think that what they're trying to do right now is to evacuate the capital. They're trying to convince people to leave Haiti on Port-au-Prince en masse. So that's a sort of environment. I mean, I can only imagine what Haiti and Port-au-Prince are like now after this earthquake. Nearly 200,000 dead. Most of the buildings that I would recognize turned to rubble. I can't imagine what I'm walking into, but what I do know is that the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund needs logistical assistance. There are several projects that are up and running right now. Soapy Deb School, which we've talked about often, and Rhea Dole, who's the godmother of my oldest son, Paolo. Rhea, of course, is the director of Soapy Deb School. It's a school that was established for the poorest children in Petionville. Nearly 400 kids. We've heard that most of the children there survived the quake, but they've been showing up at the facility, at the school, with the injured. Students from the community are showing up to the school, at the school, with injured people, as well as other injured people in the community are coming to the school. And Rhea, on her own initiative, has used the school as a makeshift hospital. We understand that the Aristide Foundation for Democracy, where there are several Cuban doctors and Haitian doctors, have
four dozen, almost over 50 doctors, 53 damn airport, and they can't get any support.
Well, they've dispatched doctors up to the Soapy Deb School so that there is a small hospital clinic triage unit working there for emergency care, as well as Rhea's house, which is sort of in the countryside of Port-au-Prince, if you will, at the end of a road called Woodfair. Her house has also been converted into a makeshift hospital because it survived the quake. So Rhea is deeply involved right now in community-based initiatives, working in conjunction with these groups of doctors at the foundation to be able to provide a wide variety of treatment and medical care for those who are in need of it, earthquake victims in Haiti. And that's the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund that's really coordinating
that
effort.
And this is a relief fund that Pierre Bossier, who we have worked closely with, and Danny Glover and Walter Riley, who along with Barbara were in Haiti during the earthquake, doing life and death work. We just heard from Sister Maureen. This is an extraordinary group of people who have been working for a long time on the ground in Haiti, and they can go to HaitiAction.net and find out more about
how to give to Haiti.
They click on and find out all the information they need about that. Give us a quick analysis of what you read in U.S. media.
Well, it's really clear that, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of cheerleading going on right now. You know, this is the U.S. effort. You go U.S., go U.S. While at the same time, the other side of the story, which are the thousands of foreign aid workers from around the world who've been turned back, or those who are already on the ground or have managed to get into the country, are also doing amazing work. I think that the press has not been focusing on their work. Instead, what we've been hearing instead are complaints from them, most notably Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, because they have every right to complain because their operations have been severely limited and set back by Obama's decision to militarize this relief operation. We know that several, I think it's almost five planes now, huge 737 planes from MSF, from Doctors Without Borders, have been turned back since last Friday. We're talking about entire field surgical units, inflatable units. In other words, it's a hospital that all you got to do is just put it up to a pump and it blows up, and it's an actual surgical theater. In a box, basically. There are several of those that have been turned back. There's thousands of pounds of antibiotics and analgesics and painkillers and blood that have been turned back because of the control factor now being instituted by the U.S. military on the ground.
Now, you're heading back. I think you're planning to go back tomorrow night, or you're going to be flying in. And you're going to, I guess, come in through the Port-au-Prince airport.
Right. I'm going in on a relief flight because I'm actually going in as a logistics coordinator, relief coordinator on the ground for HERF. I'll be working on sort of establishing the communication between the different centers that they have where they're providing medical treatment, as well as working on getting those supplies that they desperately need to them. And, of course, that means I'll be doing everything from procuring transportation to getting gasoline for generators, getting gasoline for cars. You know, it's going to be a sort of go-to job, get-it-done kind of job to provide the support that those medical teams need on the ground so that they can give that life-saving care that people desperately need right now in Haiti.
And, of course, the other side of the life and death work you do is that which has to do with information and information as a human right. We have 30 seconds, but I imagine part of your work will be meant to counteract the big lie, the dangerous Haitians, the dangers of riots, and this sort of national security framework that has defined so much of what's happened so far.
Well, you know, I'm going to go in with an open mind. Let's see what's really going on the ground. You know, it's one thing to be here, but it's quite another to be here on the ground and see it from that optic. And I'm looking forward to it. But more importantly, I'm looking forward to working as hard as I can for my family, my friends, for those communities I love, working with them as they rebuild their lives, as we try to save lives together on the ground. And again, that's the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, and you can go to HaitiAction.net to learn more.
And they can also follow your information and your reporting
on HaitiAction.net and on this station on Flashpoints at 5 o'clock Monday through Friday, Pacifica in Berkeley, California.
All right, Kevin, we wish you the best of luck. Please travel safely. We'll be in touch with you soon.
Thank you, Dennis.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and The Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.